Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is Dr. Stephen K. Green, author of the new book, Separating Church and State, A History. What's the confusion between the wall metaphor and the establishment clause? Is there real ambiguity there?
Well, interestingly enough, Thomas Jefferson, who we give credit to at least familiarizing us with this wall of separation between church and state from his 1802 letter to the Danbury Baptists, he only used that metaphor that one time, so far as we can know. Even though the Supreme Court picked up on that in 1789 and then again in 1947. But you can see in his writings that he at least reaffirms it needs to be some kind of strong line, some boundary that does separate the spheres. And we actually see James Madison, even though he never uses the exact phrase wall of separation, he uses other phrases, barrier, line, etc. And he talks more about church-state separation in his later writings than actually Thomas Jefferson does, using that phrase. Mm-hmm. So I think actually the wall metaphor has been a distraction. In a previous book, when I was looking at more of the 1940s and 1950s, I went to the Library of Congress and went through all the papers and early drafts of these opinions by the Supreme Court justices. And in the initial drafts of the 1947 opinion, when Justice Black resurrects this wall metaphor, it's not in his earlier drafts. Hmm. He actually kind of added it at the last minute in response to Justice Wiley Rutledge's dissenting opinions. And he beefed up his majority opinion and used the wall metaphor. I'm not saying it's a throwaway line, mm-hmm. but it just wasn't as necessary for the underlying principle. What has happened, though, is religious conservatives and political conservatives has seized upon this and actually elevated this idea of a impenetrable wall in a way that I don't think Jefferson or Madison ever intended the language to mean.
Looking at it from a modern perspective, what are the most important things that we need to know about the actual intent of the founders of this issue?
Well, again, I think the most thing we need to bear in mind is that they agreed on certain fundamental principles about the rights of conscience. And actually, they believed that these were natural rights, not necessarily God-given rights in the way some people misconstrue when we talk about natural rights theories. They believed that religious equality was a fundamental principle. And that was a hard one back then to actually promote that. But most of them believed that religious equality was necessary. They wanted to avoid religious dissension, something that Justice Breyer has talked a lot about in his opinions. That's an extremely potent theme. We're talking about close to 250 years ago. And in the recent memory, so to speak, of the founders were the wars of religion. And so consequently, religious dissension was a really big thing for them. And then forced support of someone else's religion through forced taxation. Those were all things that almost everybody agreed upon during that time. So in that sense, I think we can go back and look at these kind of general principles and use those today. What I'm concerned about is what Justice Alito and some of the more conservatives on the Supreme Court are doing is they're going back and kind of cherry picking history. I think it's highly disappointing. It's highly destructive to our constitutional heritage to do this. I think it is in many ways politically driven that separation of church and state has become, like other legal concepts, has become almost a partisan idea, whereas it was not something Republicans supported separation of church and state up until recently. Baptists supported separation of church and state up until recently. And so I find that highly troubling that it has become this kind of divisive issue. As a law professor and a lawyer, as well as a historian, what I find also very perplexing is the conservative members of the Supreme Court are attacking separation of church and state like it was forced upon them by some alien force, instead of being a concept that they embraced 50 years ago and less than 50 years ago. And then more specifically, how they're going about changing core jurisprudence. I mean, throughout most of the history, this idea that you don't fund religion was mandated by the Establishment Clause. Recently, within the last 5 years, the Supreme Court has said, if you don't fund religion, then you're discriminating against religion. You're showing hostility toward religion. And the Establishment Clause doesn't stand, shouldn't bar that. And so they're kind of turning the world upside down on some of these fundamental ideas that we have.
Steve, I wonder if we might lean on your expertise in helping us think about a current hot topic. The Supreme Court is considering the issue of prayer at public schools, sporting events. You've argued a number of cases before the High Court yourself, including one in 2000 that resulted in a ban on just this kind of school-sanctioned prayer. So you're the perfect person to ask why the issue is so important, how the justices got it right back then, and what's at stake today in Bremerton.
Yeah, this is about a football coach in Bremerton High School outside Seattle who has insisted that he has a protected right at the conclusion of a football game when it is still clearly a school-sponsored event to go on the football field and pray and to invite anyone who wants to, which basically means all of his teammates, to come on and pray with him on the middle of the football field. Right. If you and I were at that game and we rushed onto the football field at the end of the game, the police would drag us off the field. So Mr. Kennedy is not going onto the football field in the capacity as a private citizen. He's going on in the capacity that he is there as a coach, which is a public employee. And so he's engaging in very demonstrative religious activity. It would be like my seventh grade daughter's teacher in one of her classes saying, oh, I'm going to all of a sudden stand up and pray and read the Bible out loud to you, a captive audience. Yeah. And I have a free exercise right to do it there and then. And if you say the Establishment Clause prohibits that, you're discriminating against me. Mm-hmm. Without a doubt, this is turning the 1962 and 1963 school prayer cases on their head.
Yeah.
A football coach, more than probably any teacher, is someone who the students will look up to, who has subtle coercive authority over the students. So consequently, to say that there's nothing else going on here, all I'm doing is praying, and I have a right to do that. Again, I don't think it doesn't pay any respect to the facts.
Dr. Stephen K. Green is professor of law, director of the Center for Religion, Law, and Democracy, and affiliated professor of history and religious studies at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon. His important past books include Inventing a Christian America, The Myth of the Religious Founding. Dr. Green's latest is titled Separating Church and State, A History, just published by Cornell University Press. Steve, thank you for taking this important topic on and for being with us again on State of Belief Radio. You're always welcome with your insights.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We need to take one last break and then Faith for Pride. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy.